Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's the Clash of the Titans Terrifying Halloween Countdown Special!
Welcome to Clash of the Titles, the podcast that sees two movies with something in common go head-to-head to see which one does it better. And welcome to part two of this week's
Halloween Countdown Special,
where we're dealing with a pagan punch-up. So, on Monday's episode, we watched God-fearing Edward Woodward get hot under the collar on Summer Isle, Scotland. And today, we're going to Summer's Isle off the northwest coast of America, where bee-fearing Nicolas Cage is the man who is overcooked in every possible way. From 2006, it's Neil DeBute's remake of The Wicker Man. We'll have a champion by the end of the show, but which film will it be? Let's find out. It's Clash of the Titles.
Release the Kraken.
Hello, Clash Potters. Step away from the bike. I'm Alex Zane.
I'm Chris Tilley.
And we have no Victoria once again this week, but we do have, offering his expert opinion on today's film, the director of Fright Fest, a man who, if you cut him, he would bleed pure horror, the wonderful Paul McAvoy. Hello, Paul.
Hello, Alex, and hello, Chris.
Hello, Paul.
Great to have you back.
Thank you.
Are you looking forward to today's film?
Oh, I cannot wait. Oh.
All right, I won't spoil it. We won't go too early on this one, because... wow. Just wow. Wow, wow, wow. So we mentioned Fright Fest on Monday's episode, but a quick reminder, touch wood, it is going to be happening potentially in person the end of the month.
Hopefully some form of a physical event. Could also possibly, well, definitely going to be a digital as well, but we're crossing fingers, hoping that it'll be a physical and digital.
But no, it looks, well, I'm saying it looks, there's not going to be the wonderful Fright Fest stalwart that is the quiz, because I hosted it last year. It was so much fun. I had a great time.
We'll have to do it next year, hopefully.
It's also the toughest quiz in the world. It was so hard.
It was Andy Nyman questions. Giles Edwards questions. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Tough. But we will say we are recording this a couple of weeks before this goes out, and things are changing really fast. So if you want the latest news on what's happening in Fright Fest, head to frightfest.co.uk.
Yes, indeed.
So let's get straight into this, because, we can sort of avoid the truth of this episode for as long as we like, but eventually we will have to get to it. The truth is that I picked these movies, The Wicker Man versus The Wicker Man remake. I gave this film to Victoria, and on her first ever week of being absent from the show,
She somehow managed to dodge this bullet and palm off a film that I gave to her back onto me. So I now have the task of going through the Wicker Man remake.
When she messaged you and me about this, you went, wow, so the first time you're ever off and you're giving me the Wicker Man remake.
Yep. Yep. All right, let's do this.
And as you said, three middle-aged men talking about the Wicker Man remake. It's perfect. It couldn't be better, could it?
I mean, of all the shows, she must be seething that she's not here to do this film justice, because I imagine she would have a lot to say.
She'd have some thoughts.
About a matriarchal society that we are probably going to totally ignore. all right, if you are both ready then, strap in, ladies and gentlemen, Clash Podders one and all, here is the synopsis to The Wicker Man. Nicolas Cage stars as Edward Malice, a police officer who's allergic to bees and unbelievably ends up searching for a missing girl on a honey-producing island that is home to a billion bees and a strange matriarchal neo-pagan community.
Will you tell us what man represents in his purest form?
Phallic symbol, phallic symbol.
How dare you stand there and frighten my children?
He's been invited there by his ex-fiancée, who disappeared years ago, but now turns up and claims the missing girl is their daughter. Remember, at this point, Nicolas Cage is a police officer who at no point questions any of this. Anyway, once there, he has to deal with all kinds of things, like a mystery object in a bag, which may or may not be a shark.
What's in the bag? A shark or something?
People who won't step away from the bike.
Step away from the bike.
Dolls that offer no explanation to how they got burned. And of course, the bees. Not the bees.
What is that? What is that? What is it? Oh, no, not the bees! Not the bees! Ah!
Then he gets burned alive, the end.
Wow. 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 Wow.
Ladies and gentlemen, for your consideration, the Wicker Man remake.
I have a daughter. Her name is Rowan. She has been missing for 2 weeks now. I fear she is in danger, so now I turn to you. Be careful and believe nothing that you see or hear.
Lost your bearings?
Oh, hey, sorry. Snuck up on me there.
This is private property.
Do you know her?
I don't recognize this child.
Welcome. My little girl is still here. Has been taken by who I don't know.
I'll find her.
If she existed, we would know of her.
Whose desk is this, Rowan? Hello?
You suspect foul play.
Hey! Wicker Man returns.
Who's the Wicker Man?
I'm gonna search every inch of this town.
She'll burn to death. She burned to death.
I need your help.
Daddy.
So, let's start with your personal histories with this movie. Paul, have you watched this before?
I had watched it before, and certain elements of it were indelible. The punching of nuns, the bike motif, the bike... it was worse than I remembered it. And I remembered it being pretty bad.
Chris?
So, obviously, being a big Wicker Man fan, I was... You don't want to see your favourite films remade. But then when I heard Neil LaBute was doing it...
Because Neil LaBute, it sounds like... he's French, it's Neil LaBute, but he's giving it a French twist.
He'd made some really interesting films before this. Mm. And then when I heard it was going to be about this fully matriarchal society... done by him, who made quite political films and plays. Mm. I thought, oh, that could be interesting. And then when I heard what the film was actually like, I never watched it. I didn't want to watch it. I wasn't interested. And I watched it for the first time yesterday.
Oh, this was your first watch as well?
This was a first time watch because everyone, I just didn't need it in my brain. It felt like a waste of time.
And so it was a first watch for me as well, for exactly the same reason. You read some reviews and then you just basically end up going, well, how long am I going to be on this planet?
Yeah.
What is more important, eating this sandwich or watching the Wicker Man remake?
And then based on obviously the memes that have come out about it, there's a famous YouTube video about of Nicolas Cage performances, that's sort of got me a little bit more interested in it again. So I was really pleased when you picked it because I thought it will actually, this could be fun.
Yeah. Mm. There's an interesting thing about those memes, though, because a lot of fans of Nicolas Cage argue that this came out shortly after sort of the advent of YouTube. And suddenly on YouTube, you had people uploading just all the ridiculous moments from this movie taken completely out of context. Mm. And Nicolas Cage fans are like, this really isn't fair on him because you're just laughing at moments that without seeing the context, you know, might actually make sense. And some people actually join this and this movie and all these videos on YouTube with a kind of a downturn in his box office ability because people sort of start to, like you say, put compilations of his other performance and this idea of crazy Nick, like, and his crazy eyes came about as a result of this movie. So this movie has a lot to answer for.
It was the dawning of Cage Rage.
Mm. That's the one. That's a phrase I was looking for.
Didn't he also have some seriously big tax bills? And so he started churning out DTV stuff.
Yeah.
That's what really happened.
Well, weirdly, that's sort of like, there was a couple before this, but it's after this that we got the likes of Bangkok Dangerous and, you know, some really...
And now he's making really cool, interesting genre films that, you know, I'm sure you guys have programmed some of them. I've seen them at festivals. Yeah. And like, he's doing what he should be doing right now.
Yeah, Mandy, amazing. Oh, Colour Out of Space, fabulous.
Really cool stuff.
Yeah, well, I'll give you, as well as our histories with this movie, I'll tell you a little bit about Neil LaBute's history with this movie. I come to The Wicker Man as a fan, but I've never felt like I can't touch it because I want to go in a different direction. You'll still have the original, and while we end up in the same place, it's a very different journey to get there. You're not wrong. You are not wrong. And he says, if people are fair, they'll see how very different two films can be about the same material. That's not fair. That's just an observation. That's just sort of going, yeah, they are very, very different, Neil. So it came out in an era of horror remakes, the noughties. There'd been talk of actually remaking it since the 1990s. The rights were optioned by Universal. And in March 2002, it was revealed that Neil LaBute was writing and directing The Wicker Man, starring Nicolas Cage, made by Nicolas Cage's production company, Saturn Films. So he's actually a producer on this as well. Nicolas Cage's interest in doing this film was because his friend, Johnny Ramone, of The Ramones, he says, my late friend Johnny Ramone invited me to come over and see this movie, The Wicker Man. I was extremely disturbed by it, and it stayed with me for a couple of weeks. Hmm. I mean, that's kind of what happened to me. Didn't want to remake it, though.
No, did not. Me neither. Me neither. I thought, oh, that's good. Let's leave well enough alone.
I think Vicky brought this up when I was talking to her about doing this movie, and she was like, I'm so shocked to find out this isn't a passion project for Neil LaBute. And I am too. You sort of go, if you're going to touch that original, you've got to sort of come at it like, you know what? It inspired me in a way that has lived with me since I first saw it, and this is what I want to do with it. Mm. And he sort of says, I came to it almost accidentally. A bit about Neil LaBute, first of all, because you kind of touched on this, Chris, and I don't know his early work. I don't know In the Company of Men and Your Friends and Neighbours, but reading around them, he has this nickname as Neil LaBrute, the Mormon misogynist, the suave, savage architect of lacerating anti-date movies in which male characters channel anger and sadism towards women.
Yeah, but you could say he's having a go at what we now call toxic masculinity, is what these films are ultimately about, because these characters are the villains, the male characters in his film. So
yep,
that's what I thought could make this interesting. Turns out not.
Yeah. Well, it just feels like he sort of went, I've got an idea. He wasn't even meant to be directing it, and he was sort of talking to people, the film studios, and like they were sort of going, have you got any ideas? Just by the by. about this movie. And he said, this is an actual quote from him. It wasn't me going to anybody else and saying, hey, I'd love to remake The Wicker Man. While I'd always thought it was the kind of movie ripe for a remake because I'd always loved it, I didn't think it was particularly well made. It was a blast to watch, but it makes you giggle too. All right. It's just all of this before the movie came out, by the way. And it's important to know that. So he said it's very much the same idea here. It was kind of like, what's another version? We can't exactly do the same religious idea. I mean, not that you couldn't, but we opted not to. So I threw out this notion of this matriarchal society and this sort of honeycomb of a plot. And they said, great. And they thought, who better to create it? And so off I went.
I love the way you used the honeycomb of a plot.
Mm.
So he got forced into it, basically, is what he's saying.
It feels like a shrug. It feels like, yes, all right.
Completely.
Then.
And you know what? I listened to the director's commentary on the DVD of this. It's Neil with producer Norm Golightly and editor Joe Plotch. And it feels like their hearts aren't in it. I mean, he's very pleased with his work on the film, that's for sure.
Sorry.
But he... it doesn't seem like he's particularly connected to it.
Mm. And you know what? You really get that feel when you're sort of reading round that question. Now, he is famous for sort of not wanting to basically answer the question of what his movies are about. He kind of likes a discussion around them. So you can sort of go, well, he's doing that. But when he's been asked about, so what is this about? What is this matriarchal society? What is the theme of this movie? And the answers are just sort of so wishy-washy that you're like, I just don't know if you know. He sort of goes, this male-female power shift, a kind of a masculinization. I think I'm touching on that more than anything. And then he goes, it's been 30 years and I think I've got a legitimate idea about it. It's an island of women and Nicolas Cage. That sounds like an evenly matched game to me. You're like, but what are you saying, Neil? What is this about? And then he goes, well, there was definitely an idea to make not so much a cautionary tale, but to take this to its illogical conclusion and have fun with it. Put this guy in this position, the position that the young woman usually finds herself in, running through some town of backwoodsmen, and this guy who thinks he's got the power of the police and the patriarchy and all these things in his pocket, and then take those things away and put him on a bike, and he's running around the island on his little shirt and tie, and you're like, it's like a mashup of sort of like different themes.
Mm. Yeah, and I was excited to listen to that commentary because I thought, I might get some answer to some quite basic questions I've got about why scenes exist in this film. And I don't think there are answers to them. There's no depth. It's quite a bad commentary, if I'm honest. And there's no depth to anything he says, really, because I don't think he knows why he did half the things in this film. Because it'll look good, or because it'll sound good, or because we think it'll be funny, or... It's bizarre how this came together.
The industry of the original Summer Isle was apples. He says, here we've changed it to honey, bees. There was something fairly innocuous about apples, but with bees, every step on the island could be dangerous. He becomes more and more on his own, and the power of the women begins to grow. It doesn't. Wow. They're powerful from the start. It just doesn't make sense. So at this point, I gave up trying to sort of fight. Because I watched it, and then I was like, right. Maybe there is something I've missed here. Maybe I'm going to find out something.
It's one of those films where talking about it is actually more fun than actually putting yourself through the watching of the film. Until about an hour in, it's so po-faced and so boring.
I didn't find it
not
enjoyable.
And then finally it clicks into gear when it goes into ridiculous gear with the nun stuff, etc.
I find it relatively entertaining.
So boring.
I honestly found it relatively entertaining. I didn't think it was very good. But I found myself enjoying watching it. But I think the best example is what I said on the last episode, is where LeBute decided to put an extra S in Summer Isle.
Mm.
And there's no reason to do that. He said, because I thought it would sound better and be easy to say. And then he found it harder to say through the rest of the commentary, so it wasn't easier to say. So you're just doing things for the sake of it without any real thought.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean... Like you, Paul, I watched them both back to back, which is quite an interesting experience because he sort of does cherry pick moments from the original, actual lines. Yep. And that's very jarring because they sort of stand out as quite good lines around the rest of the conversations. He did say, in the preamble to this being released, there are people out there who say, literally, I don't care if it's good or bad. I hate the fact that they're doing it. So that's a difficult audience to work with. It certainly included the original film's director, Robin Hardy. He said, "I can't stand the idea of a new version. I won't be seeing it. I think it's a crime." That's about it. Although, based on how much I love the folk songs in the original, just to really get my goat at the very end of my research, he goes, "I don't have nearly as many songs. It's surprising how many people say it's their favourite soundtrack, the original." I'm like, come on. You may not like the new one, but if that's your favourite soundtrack, I don't know if I want you to like my film.
Wow. And Angelo Badalamenti's score for this is, and I love him, he's worked with David Lynch, etc., is so good. It's so pedestrian and so on the nose.
It's for the wrong film. It doesn't feel like it's for this film.
No.
But interesting on the commentary, they'd obviously recorded it. It was specifically for the English DVD. And I guess some reviews had come out in America before they did it. And so reviews had been laughing at the film. And I don't know if I came at this film ready to laugh because of the YouTube videos. Of course, they made me laugh. I was waiting for certain scenes. Mm. But this is right at the start of before the YouTube videos. He said critics were laughing at it and in their reviews saying it was unintentionally funny. He said, but all the laughs are intentional in this film.
I think... Because I've been quite harsh on him because I got a bit angry as I was researching it because it was just a quagmire of half sentences and no answers.
A bit like this podcast.
But he does say at one point that there was a butting of heads in the production, and who the other people were, he doesn't say, but he does say, look, we came to it like, making, the setup being funny. A bit like the original, this idea that, it's a curveball because you sort of like, you're disarmed by all this silliness and these sort of like odd moments, and you're like, oh, this is quite charming and it's kind of funny. And then bang, you get the ending of the original, and it was there to shock people. But he said there were people trying to put jump scares into this, which he didn't agree with.
Well, Nicolas Cage said, "There is a mischievous mind at work on The Wicker Man. You know what I mean? And I finally kind of said it. I might have known that the movie was meant to be absurd. But saying that now after the fact is okay. But to say it before the fact is not, because you have to let the movie have its own life." Now, I think what he means there is that he couldn't say it was supposed to be funny until audiences found it funny, which is, I think that's hedging your bets there, isn't it?
Yeah, because he said that in 2010. So 4 years, he's like, I knew all along.
Yep.
I knew all along. Right. Let's get to going through the film, but just, I have one question, which kind of ties into what you've just said. What do you make of Nicolas Cage's performance in this? Because, like you just said, do we think that he has gone, this script is not great, or it's like, it's funny, I'm going to play this for laughs? Or do you think he's sort of gone, no, this is the performance I'm giving, and I don't know if it's going to be funny or not?
It's an odd one, isn't it? Because he plays it straight up until about 51 minutes in, and then it just flips. Up until that point, I think he does it okay. I mean, he's like fish out of water, obviously. But then I like it when he goes into like that makes the film funny. Is when he does all the nun stuff and the bike stuff and stuff like that.
And arguably, like those jokes are shot fantastically as well. Like, yeah. Actually, like Neil Abute, like the direction of the bit where he runs into the room and unmasks the three kids and then jogs out again, yep. And it's like all one shot, and you're like, it's a farcical comic moment, and it's done very well.
But I love it when he answers the phone as well. Suddenly he's got the mobile phone for the first time, and was it Frank or something? Hello, Frank.
I think he's quite bad in this film. I think he makes a series of really bad acting decisions. As you say, maybe he was trying to amuse himself.
You see, I don't. I think he's fantastic in this. I really do. I think he's absolutely brilliant. And I would watch this again for his performance and for the jokes. I did not hate this movie. Everything I've said,
I didn't hate it.
I got a bit annoyed with sort of trying to find out stuff about this movie and there being no real, it all got very wishy-washy. But as a film, to sit down and watch, probably with a beer in your hand, This is great fun. Yeah.
This would be a good film to watch at a midnight screening, which doesn't seem to happen. It hasn't really taken off in that way that other films have, but I could totally imagine that, which is weird to say because I didn't watch it because I was offended at the idea of it in the first place. But actually, I had fun with it.
Right then. Well, right. Let's see how much fun we have going through this.
I think I'm going to keep contradicting myself today. I hated it. I loved it. I hated it.
I feel the same. Like, part of... I think... part of me is like, I have to accept that this isn't a great film. And that other part of me is like, I love an awful film. I really do love a bad film, and a bad film like this that never lets on. I honestly think, we'll get onto it later, because I think there's something insanely clever about what Nicolas Cage does with his performance. Screw it, okay. I'll just do it now. I think it's the fact that what he does with his performance in this movie is walk a line that is so narrow, whereby he is playing like it, knowing it's funny and knowing it's a ridiculous thing and knowing these scenes are preposterous, and he's playing them for laughs, but he's playing them for laughs in such a way that if any studio heads saw those rushes and went, what the fuck is this? We're making a horror movie here. He can legitimately say, I'm not playing that for laughs. Like, it's on such a narrow like path that he could legitimately look them in the eye and go, that's my performance in this movie.
And I 100% disagree. I think that some of the stuff that spoils it is what he's doing. And we'll get to them. We'll talk about them later.
All right, shall we take a quick break now and then get into the movie? Let's do that.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Join me, Melissa Reddy, and listen to my brand new podcast, Between the Lines. I'll be speaking to the biggest names in football about the captivating, behind-the-scenes stories fans want to hear. From major talking points to untold anecdotes, you'll hear from some of football's leading stars as well as those working in the shadows. In our first episode, I spoke to former Spurs manager Maurizio Pochettino about that Amazon documentary.
We feel responsible because it was very difficult to say yes to open the door to Amazon. Only we watched with Jesus the 25-minute first, because it was until we left the club.
And on our latest episode, I investigate how prevalent and damaging social media abuse is in football.
And I was like taking all this negativity onto myself, and I did. I kind of lost myself and my personality because I knew everything that was going on around it. And it's not until I actually got to a stage where I thought, I can't take this anymore. It is becoming too much for me, that I spoke out about it.
Craving football insight? Well, look no further. Listen to Between the Lines with me, Melissa Reddy, via Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you get your podcasts.
This was a Stakhanov production.
All right then, we are back to go through the Wicker Man remake. So, we start, and old Cage is flicking through some books in a service station in a completely unresolved and unnecessary subplot where he purchases self-help books. I don't know what that's about. This is before he's had his traumatic incident, so he's just a guy.
This is one of those things I was hoping for an explanation on the commentary, and I think it was just so Neil LeBute could put two of his mates in the film. So the person on the front of the book is either the producer or the editor, dressed like Christopher Lee is dressed in the original Wicker Man, and sitting at the diner. I don't know if you recognised him, but Aaron Eckhart sitting at the diner having a burger. And Aaron Eckhart had an unbroken record at the time of being in all his films. So I genuinely think it was just so he could put his two mates in a film, but not the opening scene.
And also a completely unnecessary scene. Nothing happens in that scene. Absolutely nothing. What happens next? A lot happens all of a sudden. So he stops a mother and child in their car. He's a motorcycle cop because their precocious little girl has thrown her doll out of the window, something that she ultimately repeats the action, which ends in her fiery death. Or does it? I think we'll resolve that question at the very end of this show in, like, the most preposterous plot point in the whole...
I mean, I'll be impressed if you can resolve it, because I couldn't bloody resolve when I was watching it.
What I mean by that is how the fucking film resolves it, because there is no way to resolve it. It's the most inexplicable thing, because throughout this movie, through the visions he has, we're sort of left sort of trying to work out if that mother and child were in the car when it exploded, even though they were.
And I love the way you say throughout this film, because... again, they keep showing that same bloody sequence again and again and again.
This is his PTSD, isn't it? The idea is...
Yeah. I mean, Neil LeBute says of this opening, because off the back of this accident and the trauma it causes him, where, you know, he stops the car and gets hit by the truck and two people either do or don't die, Neil LeBute says it allowed us to add some additional things to the story, as in, because he's on these pills, what was real and what was unreal. Rather than it being straight up, this guy seems steadfast and always says his prayers. He's on the up and up all the time. No, this guy has been through some trauma, and therefore, with medication and all that, you can afford yourself some lateral movement in terms of what's real and what's not.
And that's not a bad idea. Like, I like lots of things that they changed, I think, are interesting changes. I just don't think they work in the film, but they're good ideas.
Mm. Yeah. Are they? All right. Yeah, no, they are.
There'll be more.
So enter a friendly female police officer to see if he's okay at his home.
What's she called?
I didn't find out her name.
Forrest.
Is she?
They've all got flowery names. So little clue at the start of the film. All the sisters have flowery names.
Yeah, right. Okay. Well, interesting, because she says to him that they never found the bodies in the car. And then she hands him some letters, including one from his ex-fiancée, Willow Woodward. So just to be absolutely clear, that's taking the surname of the leading actor from the original film and the first name of Britt Eklund's character in the original film.
It's really clever stuff.
It's insane.
Well, what's Nicolas Cage's character called?
Well, Edward Malice.
Edward. So he's Edward, she's Woodward.
Yeah.
And Malice.
So if they had got married, she'd have been... Wait.
No, she would have been Willow Malice. But yeah. She's Edward. And he's Malice. That's male and phallus combined. I mean, it's really... Some of it isn't that clever going on in this film.
It turns out she wants help finding a missing daughter, Rowan, in the most insanely long piece of narration in a film. She's reading the letter that he's reading, but on the on screen... Her narration of reading letter continues beyond him finishing the letter, looking at a photo, turning on his computer, Googling Summer's Isle and answering the phone, at which point she is still narrating the letter he put down 20 minutes ago in screen time.
Oh, it's a shame. It's a shame Vicky isn't here because she loves a bit of narration, doesn't she?
She
loves voiceover.
Anyway, he then another sort of perplexing scene where he goes to the police station. Seems unnecessary. His male counterpart is there, and he sort of explains what he's going to do. And this male counterpart basically sort of goes, "Are you sure? I mean, it sounds like a stupid thing to do." In one of the best pieces of advice in the film, he sort of goes, "Don't do this. You know, she must have the father of the child. You haven't seen her for years. Probably don't go. I mean, Summer's Isle. What is that anyway?" And I just wonder whether at this point. They're trying to create an idea that the men in this world are his friends, and this is an early setup for the women being quite off with him because he's quite chummy with this male police officer, and then the female officer Forrest sort of comes in, sticks her head in, and he's sort of very dismissive. He goes, "You all right? What's up?" And you're like, "I wonder if this is sort of setting him up as this kind of very sort of right leaning." Kind of misogynist.
Maybe. I did not read that into that scene. No. But I did notice something fun in that police station. There's a missing poster. Did you see the missing poster on the wall?
No.
It is Neil Howie. Edward Woodward from the original Wicker Man. There's a missing poster with his face on it on the wall.
It's just so confusing, though. So is this set around the same time that he went missing?
I mean, I feel like it's more an in-joke than a shared universe, but there would be. They're still looking for him.
The Wickerverse.
The Wickerverse.
So he decides to go to Summer's Isle. And just to sort of the button on that scene, it's the weirdest end to that scene. Because the other police officer goes, "Summer's Isle," like it's funny, like it's a funny name. And then the scene cuts to him on the ferry where he has a hallucination. So you want a jump scare. And a jump scare, by Neil LaBute's own admission, he's like, they wanted to put jump scares in this. And a jump scare can be anything with the right piece of music. You could throw a cat onto screen and play the right piece of music. People are going to jump because it's set up as a jump scare. And he tests that to the nth degree by having a jump scare which involves an articulated lorry driving along the deck of a fucking ship.
The girl is wearing red, though. Did you not think there was a bit of a Don't Look Now motif in the fact that you keep seeing this ghostly red apparition?
I guess so.
Which you wouldn't know because you haven't seen it, but it's a Don't Look Now motif.
Don't shame me. Don't shame me for not having seen Don't Look Now. I'm waiting for us to do it on the pod.
So do look now.
Where are you? Where are you emotionally at this point in the film, Paul? Are you sold on this opening, or are you already bored?
Absolutely not. I mean, it's almost words fail me. I think the biggest problem with the film, with this film, is the direction by Neil LaBute. He's obviously not into horror. But he's taking one of the sacred horror works and remaking it with not an ounce of passion for the genre. So none of the scares work. Nothing works about this film. It doesn't work as a drama. It definitely doesn't work as a horror. It just doesn't work.
It's 1 hour 45 minutes long. And if it had been an hour and a half, I'd have literally argued that... Maybe it got to the point where they just didn't have enough stuff. So they kept everything in it. Like they ran every scene from the minute he called action to the minute he called cut. Because scenes start way earlier than they should do. Yeah. They start with characters, like an example being the school teacher when she goes, "Come outside and talk to me." That should cut to them being outside. It cuts with her already outside and him walking out the door, walking right up to her, and then their conversation starts. And I'm like, were you short of footage?
Yeah, the editing is really bad, isn't it? Throughout.
Right. So let's crack on with him getting a flight to the thing off a grumpy seaplane pilot. And then we get this wonderful line, which I'm just going to play you now because I'm not doing impressions of Nicolas Cage in this because there's no point because it's just so brilliant. It's the first genuine laugh in this movie, which isn't meant to have laughs in it. Or we don't know.
What's in the bag? A shark or something?
I know what's in the bag.
Do you really?
I do because, I mean, not in the film, but on the set I know what was in the bag because they say on the commentary.
Right.
Ooh.
Any guesses?
Robin Hardy.
Some honey? I don't know.
Are that your best guesses? Robin Hardy right, and fine. Some honey?
God, a child? A trapped child?
Close. It's a dwarf in a wetsuit.
What?
Well, then why didn't they show that?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Because they wanted to keep a sense of mystery.
But okay. But it's just, it's bewildering. Like, why is it bleeding? Why is the bag bleeding?
Well, don't you think they're trying to do what the original film did by putting all these strange things that just set you, get your mind racing and put you off kilter? Yeah.
Yeah.
Confuse you.
All right. Yeah. I got that. He goes to stay at the inn in the town and meets Sister Beach, a barmaid. I have a question about this scene because initially she's very cold towards him until he asks for some mead. And she seems completely thrilled that he's going to have this this mead. And Willow, who's arrived at the same time, looks thrilled to see him until he drinks the mead. And she sees him drink the mead and she's like, oh, fuck, he's drunk the mead.
Yeah. He drinks it in one as well, almost, doesn't he? He's like drinking it back.
Any thoughts?
No, not really. Have you got any thoughts, maybe,
Chris? It's something to do with the whatnots in the mead, because that's what mead is filled with.
Right.
Yeah.
Honey, herbs, and whatnot.
Well, it's all through the bees again, isn't it? It's a bee drink.
Is it? I mean, should he be drinking honey?
No, because he's allergic, isn't he?
I think you can.
No, you can. You can have honey. I'm just putting it out there because there's a lot of strange emotions.
I feel like you've spent too much time analysing this film because now you're giving out misinformation yourself, much like this film does. If you are allergic to bees, please enjoy your honey. We're not saying stop eating honey.
Are you saying that?
Don't eat it from the source.
Are you saying that he's allergic to bees? Because it really doesn't come across in the film. They don't mention it every blooming opportunity. It's like you won't. If a character is allergic to bees, you only have to say it once.
Yeah.
We got it.
What it is, Chris, it's foreshadowing. We spoke about that for the original The Wicker Man podcast we did last time. So it's all about foreshadowing.
But you only have to do it once.
I know.
Yeah, I wrote down...
It's labouring the point.
He kills a bee. He's allergic to bees. And they make honey on this island. And it involves bees. I wonder if these two things might come into play later.
Bee helmets.
Yeah. Willow, who at this point is just the best at leaving notes, leaves him another note in his bedroom that he finds. And then she narrates as he's walking to a meeting with her where she could relay the very same information that she's left in a fucking note for him. I find her a troubling character in this because in each scene, she never finishes a sentence. And I get the idea that it's mystery, but he seems to make huge assumptions about what she's telling him without her saying anything, and it's infuriating to watch.
That's interesting. I didn't spot that, but I guess that was an artistic choice. You know, is that him not listening to women and just talking over them and not paying any attention? Vicky, yeah. Vicky, what do you think? Vicky,
help.
It's fine. We haven't even got to that stuff yet. I genuinely believe there is a possibility she might open a wormhole in this room and stick her head through just to have an opinion on the matriarchy on this island. We'll find out. So he gets back to his room. God, they're not going to leave this self-help tape subplot alone because there's one thing missing from his bag. It's his self-help tapes. What thoughts? I honestly don't know what that's meant to mean. Is it meant to mean, is it they're trying to reinforce the fact that he might be going crazy because he doesn't have his self-help tapes that he just bought at the start of the film?
Now, I'm not sure if that was in my... I watched the director's cut of this.
Right.
Have I seen a different version of this film to you two?
I don't think so. I'm pretty sure I watched...
Because my version was about 90 minutes long as well, not an hour and 47
weird,
minutes. Yeah. And I know the endings are different, so...
Which is like the echo of the original Wicker Man with the various different versions.
I did say that in the first.
Because it was obviously a PG-13, wasn't it, on its original release in the States. All horrors should not be a PG-13. They should be R-rated. Obviously, they were going for, you know, the kid market. But
I think you might have missed some good stuff at the end. We'll talk about it when we get to it. But so I don't think I saw the self-help tapes.
No, I didn't.
Okay, well, trust me. If I was going to make something up from this movie, it wouldn't be that his self-help tapes are missing. Because it's a horror movie, in part, he goes to investigate a barn. And a piece of floor gives way, and he's suspended over a crate of pitchforks. Did you see this bit?
Yes.
Okay.
Another waste of time, wasn't it?
Yeah, that felt like very much padding. Yeah. It's padding because it doesn't really go anywhere, and it's designed to up the suspense, I guess, and the scares, but it doesn't do
it
either.
It doesn't, does it? In any way, shape, or form.
And again, we're talking about the score, and the score there is just so da, 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 pitchforks below him. And you're like, all right. So then he's got the same plot point as the original film, the photos of the Harvest Festival with the final photo missing. Mm-hmm. He meets the teacher, and instead of a beetle in the desk, a crow.
Flies out in a shock moment.
It's more showy and more spectacular and not nearly as disturbing, not even approaching as messed up as the original.
Nicolas Cage's response in that moment as the crow flies out is, "What?" it's a great way of dealing with that. He then does follow that up with quite a great line. Oh, no, I've lost it. It's gone. It's gone. What he says is, "Why would you let them do a sick thing like that?" I'd argue that fitting a crow in a desk is quite difficult because they're a large, strong bird.
Yep.
So I'm not saying.
How would you get a crow in a desk?
Log flume. I'd convince it that it was going on a great journey and put it in a tiny mini log flume that I'd assembled.
Right.
And I'd be like, "You're going to love this." And the crow would be like, "I love this." And then I'd just set it on its way. And then at the very end, as it thought it was going to hit the splash zone, it'd go whoomph, straight into the desk. I'd close the lid and be like, "Never get on a log flume that I've designed, crows."
Not bad. Not bad. The correct answer is drugged milk like beer baracus. Everyone knows that. Right. That's how you get anywhere.
Paul, ever put a crow in a desk?
Not recently, no.
No?
No.
Any tips for any crow fondlers out there?
For the crow fondlers? Yep. No.
The teacher mentions, I think she's teaching something from Don Quixote in this scene.
Yes.
And that's actually from Tony Schafer's original Wicker Man script that didn't make it into the original film.
Oh.
So no real reason, again, for a lot of the things here. I mean, it's a nod to something that no one would know. And, pointless.
He does find out at this point that Rowan is dead. Sister Rose, the teacher, tells him, she's in a wonderful exchange. She goes, "She's dead. It was an accident." And he says, "Tell me what you mean." And she goes, "It was an accident." And he goes, "What happened?" She goes, "She burned to death." And he goes, "What do you mean?" And she quite rightly says, "Precisely what I meant. She burned to death. I'm not sure how... I don't know what you've not understood by she burned to death. But what do you mean she burned to death? Fire? The classic burning?"
But that's the scene where she says it differently twice, doesn't she?
I don't think so.
Sister Rose, the first... That's why he's questioning it. She says... He says, "What happened to her?" And she says, "She'll burn to death." And then he says, "What happened?" And she says, "She burned to death."
Oh, does she?
So she changes the tense.
Ooh. Uh-oh.
Yep.
I didn't realise that, and I'm not convinced, because that's quite good.
You can be convinced, because I went back and rewatched it with the subtitles on to make sure I'd heard it right, so... It's quite clever. Yeah.
But how long after the movie came out did they put those subtitles on, and how much work has been gone into those subtitles to convince people that it's a better scene than it actually
is? No, because
is.
I saw it as well. I heard it.
Okay.
I heard it.
All right. I'm not questioning your hearing, Chris. I think we should all stick to I think we should all be on the same team with this.
Sorry.
Good. then he meets Sister Rose again, who's not Sister Rose, on a bike. The woman who looks exactly... Oh, no, sorry. Just before that, he meets a woman farming, and he says, didn't I just talk to you? Because she's the same actress who plays Sister Rose.
Mm. Yeah. There's a twin thing going on the island. There's a series of twins all over the island.
Yeah.
But not at the end, when it would be really good to see Sister Rose with her twin sister, where they're all gathered around the Wicker Man. They haven't sprung the budget to do that.
He said that he spent ages working, and even on set, they were working on having it in a continuous take, where he talks to Molly Parker as Sister Rose, and then he goes around the corner, and she's meanwhile runs round, gets changed, and she can be there. And after a while, he said everyone turned to him and said, why are we doing this? And he said, I realised that there was no point and we could just cut to a different scene.
And did they go, sorry, we mean the remake in general.
Very good.
It's worth it. Stick with me, because I'm sighing a lot, because like you said at the very start, Paul, there is a point where all of this like kicks into gear and you're like, okay. Yeah. It's almost like the movie is testing us at this point to see whether you stick with it. He finds out that he's Rowan's father, which is a big deviation from the original. I'm going to come out and say, I don't mind the fact that this is his daughter. I think his reaction is a little too like, oh, you should have told me. I'd be livid if she kept this from me initially. And now, since I've been back in touch with her, she just hadn't revealed that.
Mm, I agree. I think, you know, that's one of the few good plot shifts from the original.
So he's bonded to the island by blood, is the point here.
Bonded by blood.
And it means that this plot has been going on for, like, the best part of 7 or 8 years. And that's dark, you know?
Mm.
Do you know what it reminded me of? Get Out. You know, the idea that the daughter in Get Out brings Daniel Kaluuya. He's been doing it for...
Playing the long game.
Years, yeah. So he tries to use the plane radio that's in the dock. He goes down to the dock. And this is the first time in the film that it does something really... of all the things that are just, like, bad, this I find insulting to the audience, which is the fact that... It's the horror cliche where he doesn't have a signal. Now, I don't have a problem with that in modern day horror making. I mean, you must be aware of this in so many of the films that you put on at Fright Fest. It kind of has to be done because everyone has a mobile.
Yes, exactly. You have to say, oh, we're in an area where it doesn't work or whatever, whatever. Mm. Or the batteries are low.
So it's an acceptable trope of horror. Here are a list of just a handful of the movies that use that we don't have a phone signal. Jeepers Creepers, Vacancy, The Hitcher remake, Dead End Detour, Eden Lake, Friday the 13th remake, The Mist, The Ruins, The Hills of Eyes remake, Vacancy 2, Cabin Fever, House of the Dead, Identity, Eight-Legged Freaks, Saw 5, Last House on the Left remake, Donkey Punch, Black Sheep, Wrong Turn, Quarantine, Wrong Turn 2, Dead End, The Hills of Eyes 2, Jeepers Creepers 2. All of those have a moment where someone goes... Ah, we don't have any
signal. You're genuinely better off listing horror films for the last 10 years that don't have a moment.
Right.
Because there's less.
Again, I don't have a problem with that. I have a problem that in this day and age, like, at what point has a phone which has no signal ever gone beep, 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 beep? What that says is, like, it's not enough to have him open his phone and look at it and emote that he has no signal. The film has to have a bleeping sound that no phone ever makes, ever, when it's no signal.
And the whole thing's so unnecessary because I've suspended my disbelief. This society and this island is living in the past, effectively. I don't think it even needed it in the first place.
No.
It's just taken for granted that they wouldn't have, you know, a mobile phone tower.
Yeah.
And it's established in the very first scene when he talks to the third scene when he talks to his cop mate, and the cop mate goes, "Have you tried to call?" And he goes, "You'll never guess. There's no phone signal.
Yeah, I'm done
on the island.
Exactly. Yes. I'm good. I'm good. Again, like the bees. They do it about three times.
But he suddenly gets a signal later in the film, doesn't he?
Yeah. That's an interesting point. So I think the reason they've done that is to sort of ratchet up this idea, the tension. Well, that he might be rescued.
Oh,
because it's that thing that I think it's Pete, his cop friend, where he goes, Pete, and then it starts bloody bleeping again.
Yeah. That's good. Yeah,
and it's the idea that in the final scene when he's in the Wicker Man, you know, the cavalry might arrive because Pete got that message at just the right moment.
You're right. Yeah, yeah.
Mm. So that's not a bad moment, but every other bit with a beep 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 beep, no signal. I'm a phone, no signal, unnecessary. get a bit on a jetty where he finds a floating girl under the jetty, and Neil LaBute gets to play with this idea of what's real and what's not. And we get another priceless Cage reaction when he wakes up from a dream and he's holding the dead body of his daughter. He goes, "God damn it!" It's just...
But it's two dreams, isn't it? It's a dream within a dream.
A dream within a dream.
And I think you've got to be careful with these things because you only get one shot at doing something like that, and I think it's overused in this film. Because once the audience doesn't trust you, doesn't trust the hands of the filmmaker they're in, then those moments don't work anymore. And by this point, I've had enough of them.
Yeah.
And so to stick a dream in a dream, I'm already like got my arms folded and like, yeah, whatever.
Yep.
We then get to meet Dr. Moss, who is the island photographer and storer of dead babies in jars of formaldehyde. I struggled with this bit. I don't know what. There's an entire subplot which I haven't even really referenced in this because I don't understand it, which is who those babies are, what happens to a lot of the men on the island, why the men are all deformed, what's the inbreeding subplot?
Yeah, it's an afterthought. And the way that I basically read out the information twice when I was going through the original film, because it's given to you so clearly in The Wicker Man. If you're really listening, it's fully explained to you what's happening. And here, they just don't bother. There's throwaway comments, as you say. There's imagery, disturbing imagery. But none of it really adds up to anything that's particularly coherent.
Could. So there's... because the men can't speak.
No.
There's a scene where one is covered in bee stings. I started to wonder whether the beekeepers are all the men, but then I thought no, because that's quite a good job on the island looking after the bees.
So are you talking about the guy that was lying in the bed?
Yes, that's...
So he was genuinely an extra working on the film, and that's all him.
Right.
He had these marks on his body, and he had a missing eye. Okay. And they said, actually, come here, mate. We can actually use you somewhere else in this film. And he got a bit of a pay bump, and he got his face on camera.
There's another just a wonderful scene here that just tells you so much about this movie. Nicolas Cage leaves the doctor's house and offers to help a man load some wood onto a cart, and it falls off. End scene.
Well, the idea there, though, is that those are the logs that are used to break his legs later on. And so he's effectively assisting with his own demise unwittingly.
Yep. Oh, OK. That's better than I thought. Mm. I was just like, I thought it was to emphasise this idea that the men don't speak because he tries to speak to one of the men.
That's happening too, but there's two things are happening at the same time.
Then we get the first big bee scene. Now, just to walk you through this, Nicolas Cage is allergic to bees. If he gets stung, he might die. He carries an EpiPen in case of such an event. So he's walking with his bike and he sees loads of beehives surrounded by a billion bees and does not immediately stop and turn round. He carries on walking at speed. Because he's looking at those bees, he accidentally rams his bike into a hive of more bees.
It happens.
So I tried to realise this in my own way, because obviously I have a terrifying fear of sharks. So this is like me being on a boat, seeing a school of shark fins in the water, still getting into the water, and while looking at those sharks, accidentally swimming into a hive full of sharks.
Don't do it.
Yeah, I mean, he's having a bad day. He's having a bad day.
And then it just gets worse because even when he's being attacked by those bees and he doesn't run back the way he's come. Bees tend to stick around their hives and he runs into the field of hives, banging into more hives. This is... The reason I mention this is because this is the moment when I decided in this movie, this is like 1 hour into this film where I went, all right, I'm in. You've broken me down to the point where I am now not looking for anything other than how hilariously ridiculous this film is. And it's simultaneously the moment that the film does the same thing. It goes, all right, we've done that bit. None of us really enjoyed it. It's party time.
Yes, exactly.
It's also making me think we should have paired this with Vicky's favourite, My Girl.
Death by Bees.
Yeah, the bee double.
We get to meet Ellen Burstyn, Sister Summer's Isle at this point. Thoughts on Ellen Burstyn? She's a horror icon, really.
Yeah, I mean, she was okay in it, but the sequences between her and Nicolas Cage, I mean, the way Nicolas Cage plays them with her is just, he's just terrible, isn't he? Just terrible.
Yeah, I like
and the
it.
Framing, the, that weird frame of that sequence where they're talking, which just goes on forever, and he's like stooped. So it's just really odd. Really odd.
Yeah, she's horror royalty because of The Exorcist.
Right. Fact that Neil LeBute is very proud of. He makes a point at a Q&A I watched where he goes, and obviously there's an Exorcist connection there between this and The Exorcist. Yeah.
The two other actresses they considered were Catherine Deneuve and Charlotte Rampling.
Okay.
But when they realised they could get Ellen Burstyn, she's who they wanted. And they were saying that how they feel about her in this film, the director and the producer, is that she's like Colonel Kurtz in Apocalypse Now, in that you hear about her, everyone's talking about her, but you don't meet her for an hour, and then she kind of has this presence. I don't know if she's up there with old Brando and Colonel Kurtz, but I like her in this role. Yes. I do.
Yeah.
Because she annoys me and frightens me in equal measure, which is, I think, what she's supposed to do.
Yeah. It's an interesting way of doing it because obviously in the original, I mean, I get, is it a problem that she is so confrontational? Because, I mean, she's in the Christopher Lee role, and the brilliant thing about Christopher Lee in the original, he's kind of sort of smothers in with charm, Edward Woodward. He's like, and you're disarmed because this guy's really cool about it, really like, look, you've got your own ideas, we got our ideas, cool, can we not just get along? And she's really like, she's angry and arm-foldy and confrontational.
Well, it's because she's a woman.
Right.
And they get angry with men, don't they?
Well, we do learn a little bit about that. Now, Vicky? No, nothing, not yet. No, I thought I saw
a
flicker of a time tunnel opening. So she talks about how her Celtic ancestors came to the island and rebelled against the suppression of the feminine. She does love men, but she's not subservient to them. Men, she says, are used for breeding. Nicolas Cage snorts and goes, inbreeding, more like. And then he asks quite a pertinent question, which is, what happens if someone is a boy and is born on this island? And again, it's just one of those answers where you go, I'd quite like you to allude to something here. But she just goes, it depends. It's like, yeah. On what?
So is that who's in the jar, though?
Is
that a bunch of baby boys?
Must be.
Yeah. Could be.
But who are the men on the island, then?
Well, this is the thing.
They're breeding. If they need men for breeding, they've got to breed men.
But then why are they setting off to then, like, get... Like, it sounds like a tradition where women leave the island to breed with someone like Nicolas Cage and then come back to the island and give birth to that offspring.
Hence the coda at the end.
In my version of the film, but we'll get to that.
Okay.
So then he discovers the doll in the grave. It's presumably the doll from the start that the girl threw in the road.
But again, this feels like one of those stuck-on action horror sequences, like the barn one, which it doesn't really go anywhere.
It just doesn't work.
It's there to prolong proceedings and make us feel we're watching an action horror film when actually we aren't really. Well, we are, but not a very good one.
I was looking for the clip just then of...
You can do the impression.
How do you get burned?
There we go.
How do you get burned? How do you get burned?
I've never seen Alex not do his impression, so he's embarrassed in front of people.
It's not. It's because I refuse to compete with how brilliant Cage's delivery is in this movie. I can't do it justice because it's so off-kilter.
Yeah. Great.
So we've got... he goes inside Summerisle's house. He finds a deformed man in bed covered in bee stings, which he talked about. A naked woman with a vast beard of bees.
It's a bee beard and bikini.
No, I mean, as two fans of horror and a horror aficionado, do you think he was playing this for a scare at this point? Is it because Nicolas Cage reacts like this is a horrifying image, but a grinning woman with a beard of bees?
Yeah, I feel like I've seen that in Looney Tunes cartoons.
Yes. It doesn't work, does it?
No, none of that's scary. No, that's not scary. And the next scene
if
where...
If anything, it's a talent to be celebrated. You're like, if you opened a door and saw a naked woman with a beard of bees, you'd be like, fucking well
and
done.
Also, I'll be honest, I got confused because I think she looks like that woman I thought looked like Lili Sobieski the first time I saw her. So I thought that was that woman, but then it's not that woman because she's back in a minute in a different capacity. So
okay,
I just found it confusing. Find people that look different. Mm. So you got Summer Isle under the bed sheets, though, her silk bed sheets.
In what looks like a junket room that if you ever interview Jennifer Lopez in the noughties, it would have been done out like that. Genuinely, she used to deck the hotel rooms for her junkets with like billowing white sheets, like satin sheets from the walls. And it was like you were walking into some sort of strange interpretation of heaven. I remember doing it for Made in Manhattan and just going, what the fuck is this room?
But this was supposed to be a 5-page scene here between Howie and Summer's Isle. But Cage decided it wasn't necessary. And it's interesting on the commentary, you hear that he had a lot of control over this film, being a producer, being a passion project for him. He changed a lot and had made a lot of the big decisions. But he said that when he got on the set and he was in the headspace of malice, he realised that he would just pull out his gun and put it to the head of Summer's Isle until she gave back the kid. He said it wouldn't make sense for him just sit here chatting at this point. Mm. So he completely cut that scene, and that's why he uses his gun in a similar way in the next scene. Unfortunately, it ends up being funny.
Yeah. I just deleted my step away from the bike scene for some reason.
Well, you can do it now if you like.
Step away from the bike! Just pulling a gun on someone on a bike.
So, yeah. Again, on the commentary, they say that, well, that was meant to be funny. Right. And I think it was. Yeah. I mean, it is a funny line.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it's before Nicolas Cage made Drive Angry. But if you could call this film Ride Angry, because he is...
Good.
He is cycling.
There you go.
He is cycling.
It's a nice touch that it's a woman's bike. That he's riding as well.
It doesn't look so he's ever ridden a bike in real life, though, or not for many, many years. He's kind of stumbling around with it, and yeah,
which would be acting because he's a motorbike guy, isn't he?
Yeah,
he knows
what
he's doing.
Have you ever interviewed Nicolas Cage?
No,
have you not?
No, you?
Yes, yeah. I once weirdly it was just for a radio interview for my breakfast show back on XFM back in the day, and it was for the movie Knowing, you know, the Alex Proyas movie.
How could I forget?
And he was just really like he was so bored. Like everything, like anything about Knowing, I was sort of asking him a question. He was like, you know, no. And then we got on to the subject of dinosaurs, and he was like, he just suddenly sprung to life. He was like, do you know that a chicken shares exactly the same DNA as a Tyrannosaurus Rex? And it was the most animated he'd been during the whole interview.
I love it.
And we just talked about dinosaurs.
Lovely.
Our favourite dinosaurs.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I know a few people that have worked with him and made movies with him, and everyone seems to enjoy his company.
Yeah.
He's eccentric and fun, and people seem to be genuinely excited to work with him and have enjoyed the experience.
Apparently, I mean, our friend Richard Stanley, with Colour Out of Space, which Nicholas was obviously in, he said he was fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, he just does it on cue. The rage is there, but then cut. Then he can do it again.
Yeah.
Just really professional.
Just
and really,
sound like
really
a cool guy.
Yeah.
I love
the, you must have you seen the Wogan when he was promoting Wild at Heart?
Yeah,
and he does
the
cartwheel or what, no, the, what do you call it? Forward roll. Like a
roly poly.
Yeah,
roly poly.
He's
Kung Fu Kid.
What a heart.
And then starts throwing wads of cash into the audience, like loads of money.
Cocaine is a powerful drug.
Just throwing it into the audience. And then Terry.
My snakeskin jacket.
Terry Wogan. Nicolas Cage's like, and sits down. And Terry Wogan goes, and the word of the day is understated.
Good, man.
Yeah. It's just, it's the craziest thing. I'm a huge Cage fan. I think he's just a fantastic actor who takes a role and just turns it into something completely different. I mean, especially you're sort of like the kind of, you know, a Michael Bay action hero role, like The Rock, and just turns him into this like eccentric character. It's great.
Yeah.
He's good.
Don't talk too much about The Rock yet.
Oh, yeah?
That's in our future, surely.
Of course that's
Cage
in our future.
Always eminently watchable.
Mm. Without a doubt. And like you mentioned earlier, Mandy. Oh,
yeah.
It's horrible, but it's brilliant.
Yeah, he's fantastic.
Right then, back to this, which I think...
We're near the end, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. I love the bit. I'm just going to play this bit because it doesn't make any sense to actually play it audio, but it's one of the clips that I loaded up. So you just got to, it's him running into a room and then running out again, having demasked some children.
Hey, take those masks off.
It's funny for me because I'm watching it. It probably doesn't work. you two couldn't even see that. That was just me in my own little world watching YouTube. Here we go. We get to the climax then. He's dressed as a bear at this point because the punch costume from the original has been replaced with a bear costume that he's going to use as a disguise in the procession. There is actually some logic to this. Hmm. Because Neil Abute says, I was trying to find an equivalency to the wonderful kind of punch outfit that they got the guy running around in the original. There's almost no way to top that. It was such a great, great series of costumes in the original movie. I actually think that he should have paid very much attention to that sentence. There's almost no way to top that. But nevertheless, he has. It's the Northwest with this very rural background. What kind of costumes would they actually have for a festival like this? It made sense. They've just gutted a bear and literally put the whole fucking thing on.
Well, bears like honey, you know, classically in Winnie the Pooh.
Yeah.
It's a real bear hide that he's wearing.
Okay.
And Nicolas Cage actually was very keen to wear that full outfit for the rest of the film. He didn't want to take it off again.
Well, you can tell because there's a stupid moment where he takes everything off but the bare feet.
The feet stay
on. And he's walking along.
The feet stay on.
Oh my God.
And he said, you know, that is, you know, very purposeful because he wanted to make Malice even more pathetic. He wanted to just become more and more and more pathetic. He went from, you know, being very smart in his suit, trying to impress his ex, to, you know, ending up with a pair of bare feet on.
Yeah.
Literally walking barefoot.
Brilliant. Brilliant.
That's a joke.
Yep. I know, I got it. It's sort of the equivalent of, to me, it's the equivalent of keeping your socks on when you're, you know,
and of course
which we all do.
And of course, the bear suit is brilliant foreshadowing for Midsommar, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Which obviously they utilise that motif.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. they've killed the harbour pilot at this point, and they've taken his hand, although we never do get the Hand of Glory moment, despite the fact he's missing a hand. And then... yeah, it's the climax.
Well, you've brushed past him punching three women.
He does, sorry. Yeah.
I mean, Vicky said we should probably not talk about that. Dangerous territory.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Do you have anything to add to that other than the fact that it's kind of hilarious in how outrageous it is?
Mm.
It's fundamentally funny because you're sort of going, what's going on? What's happened to him? Like...
Yeah, and the way Lily Sobieski flies across the room into the ward and stuff, it feels like it's played like for laughs. It feels like we're into slapstick territory at this point.
That's when he does the karate kick and yes. then the high kick to the face.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. So it's the end of the movie. He gets burnt in the Wicker Man
and the bee helmet.
Well, as you said, though, three characters from the start of the film show up.
Which is...
So, just to explain, the mother and child are in the car, who we watch die, and then obviously the police officer, what was her name, Forrest, both show up. They're both part of it. But then what was that scene at the start then? Like, so...
Yes, what was the scene? Because clearly two people were in that car. And they were in it when it exploded.
Yep.
So they are fireproof.
And this is when I'm thinking, well, Labute's gonna explain this in the commentary. He says, oh, that's a little nod to the beginning of the picture and his own sanity regarding what happened on the road that day.
So maybe it didn't happen.
Right, okay.
Maybe it's all a dream.
Maybe he doesn't die.
Yeah.
Maybe it is all
a
dream.
Maybe he's still alive.
Maybe there was a deleted scene where he wakes up at the end and goes,
So the theatrical cut, which I don't know if you guys saw or not, was the PG-13 version of it, where they cut his legs being broken.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right, yeah.
And they cut the bees stinging him on his head.
Mm.
That was removed, and Labute said, I had to fabricate that all using voiceover. He said it was a real struggle. And so I can't imagine watching this without... I mean, I just saw this director's cut that you see, the very graphic breaking of his legs.
Which
and all
is,
the
which
the
is great. Yeah. I did see that version.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. I think The problem is, like, you know, I mean, it's not a great movie, I think, as we've established over the course of this episode. However, there are certain things in it that people mock. Like, one of the moments that was put up on YouTube as a way of mocking this film, right at the very start, is this bit where he's on the ground and he says this.
And you're doing it for nothing! Killing me won't bring back your goddamn honey!
And yeah. That is a direct lift from the original movie. Yep. Granted, it's not delivered with quite such volume and intensity, but it's the same line.
And within context, he's fine to be that stressed out and angry and shouting and hysterical. So, yeah, it is easy to laugh at bits of this film taken out of context, easier than when you actually watch it within context. But in terms of the burning in The Wicker Man, It's just a little bit underwhelming as well. It's just not shot with the same skill that Hardy does it. That beautiful sunset happening in the background.
Although there is something to be said for the bit where he's begging his own daughter to not light the bonfire at the bottom. That change is quite good.
Especially as she has this quite serene smile on her face while she's doing it.
Yeah.
She's not holding a lit flame, by the way. That's CGI. He said they weren't allowed to give a child a lit flame like that. But
I find the performance I struggle with is that of Willow in this final scene, because she seems to go just like... In the defence of that performance, let's just say that like she is dealing with a script that is a bit wishy-washy and a tone that is all over the place. So, you know, it is forgivable. But she ranges from second to second, frame to frame, between being absolutely mortified that this is happening to Nicolas Cage and then also like she's taken so much acid that she's not even there. It's
really strange, isn't it?
Well, she's supposedly having second thoughts and feeling some sadness because... she liked this man. But I just remembered this, now you brought it up, that I don't know if it's the editor or the producer, but one of them on that commentary says, oh, I didn't like her performance in this scene. I didn't like what she's doing with her face, but I didn't tell her. I made sure I didn't tell her. And Lubute's like, well, she's going to hear it now. You just said it on the... She goes, oh, no, I like everything else she does, but just in this scene, I really don't think it works.
It's really confusing because what you want is for, at that point, her to just be so, like, stoic and just be like, this is part of the system, which is what she kind of is saying. Every time she opens her mouth, she's like, this is what happens. We planned this from the start. And then she'll look really mournful and be like, oh, should we be doing this? It's very confusing.
And from that, it's hard to tell if that was her fault or the director's fault. But she's not particularly good in the film, though, either, I don't think.
You know, she'll hear that.
Yeah, I'm not. I'm
all right. Yeah, I mean, you didn't edit it, so that's fine. Right then, that's pretty much all I've got.
So who got the coda and who didn't at the end of the film?
I got the coda.
You get the coda?
What's the coda?
So the film doesn't end with The Wicker Man in the theatrical cut.
Oh.
The film ends 6 months later. Mm-hmm. We're in a bar with a pair of off-duty cops played by Jason Ritter and James Franco. And they meet Sister Willow and Sister Honey. And while Sister Willow goes to the bar with one of the men, Sister Honey asks to go home with the other, clearly setting them up in the same way they set up Edward.
What?
Which... it's amazing. I'm listening to the commentary. I'm thinking, oh, well, he'll explain why it's not on this version. And he just said, we cut it. He doesn't say why.
He doesn't say why.
So he literally, I mean, it's quite an important, it's like 5 minutes long, and it's quite an important ending to then get rid. I mean, it was interesting. It's not the powerful ending that the friggin' Wicker Man ending is, you know?
I think obviously the original Wicker Man, the cut to the end is so powerful.
Yeah.
Whereas... I didn't hate the coda.
No, it's different. Quite, you know, say you're going to remake it, do it different or better, and it's different. Yeah. And you know, to show that this is an ongoing, you know, conspiracy happening,
saga.
And James Franco's next in the sequel
in the Wickerverse.
Wow. I'm sure I saw the same version of you because I saw the leg breaks. I didn't stay past. I was very keen to get out of there. So the minute it goes for Johnny Ramone appears on the screen, I was like, off. But I watched the director's cut because I saw the leg breaks. Would I have seen that?
Yeah, the director's cut doesn't have it in.
Oh.
It was cut out of the director's cut. This was on the theatrical version.
Oh, okay.
So it's weird.
So we've come full circle then from Neil Labute not really explaining much before the movie was released about what it's meant to be about, to him not explaining why he made any decisions cutting things from the film at the end. Excellent news. I mean, just for completion's sake.
What is it?
What is it? What is that? What is that? What is it? Oh, no, no, not the bees! Not the bees! Ah! Oh, no, my eyes! My eyes! Ah! Ah!
Good.
Acting.
Hey.
Acting.
It seems so unnecessary as well.
Please.
But the fact that they kill him once, they smash his legs and sting him to death and then bring him back to life to burn him.
Yep.
There's something about it being a purification ritual, which seems like another thing someone's gone.
It was a bad day for Nicholas that day.
It was unnecessary killing him once, but it's call it purification. Right, let's do the bits. Unless anyone has any more for any more.
Nah, go for it.
What is your best scene? Paul.
The bee helmet,
yeah,
which we didn't see coming. We couldn't see that being foreshadowed in any way, shape, or form. There's actually so much that's good about the film, isn't there? In such a bad way.
Yeah. Yeah.
What about you, Chris?
There was something I didn't see coming that genuinely made me laugh out loud, with shock and mirth. And that was, the film being dedicated to Johnny Ramone at the end.
Yeah.
What the fuck? I just didn't see that coming. And it's so bizarre. And especially if you don't know the context, you don't know why. It's just, what? Like, why would you dedicate that to him? Mm. So that was impressed me.
Would he have wanted it dedicated to him?
Not.
He was not.
Such a fan of the original film that he invited Nick Cage over, showed it to him.
Yeah. And said, don't ever remake this, Nick.
Then he made that travesty, yeah.
Nick Cage sort of took it upon himself to go, I see what you're saying here, Johnny. What you're saying is go away, remake this, and dedicate it to you.
In a bad way.
I think the moment that you find out that Sister Summer Isle is Willow's mum, I like that because it turns this into the ultimate mother-in-law joke,
yep,
which I think is quite funny.
Yeah.
But actually, I think the best scene in this film is not a scene in this film, but a YouTube video called Nicolas Cage Losing His Shit. So everyone should just go watch that.
Yep.
Because that's a masterpiece. Alex, what about you?
There's also a very funny on YouTube comedy trailer where it's reworked as a sort of a heartwarming family comedy. They've retaken scenes from this.
Oh, I'll have to check it out.
And it's him, it's Nicolas Cage taking over the family honey business that he's had no interest in. My best scene is the moment he jogs into a room, takes three girls' masks off, and then jogs out again. It's just the best joke in the film.
Good bit of jogging.
MVW, we'll start with you, Chris, most valuable, whatever.
I think Ellen Burstyn's really good. I think her performance is from a much better film. So I'm with her on this one. That's my pick.
Paul?
Oh, God. The most valuable piece of the film? Or the most...
Person, actor, performance, prop, song?
It's got to be Nicholas, isn't it?
Yeah.
When he bursts into the full or semi-full Cage ragey style stuff at about the 52-minute point.
Yeah.
From there on, you're on a lovely Cage roller coaster, aren't you?
Yeah.
Fair enough.
And finally, I'm going with Paul on this one, Cage as well. I think, like I said at the start, this is when I my want is to blurt something out before saving it for the moment when I could say it. I just think he walks this magnificent line here between taking the piss and not taking a piss, the piss out of a movie he's actually starring in. You're just never sure. And I think it's wonderful. What would you change, Christopher?
I mean, I initially went into this thinking I would want to wipe it from existence, but I don't. I did enjoy watching it. I found some entertainment in it. So I want to change something that doesn't exist into something that does exist. And so this is a quote from Nicolas Cage. He said, a few years ago, he said, "I would like to hook up with one of the great Japanese filmmakers like the master that made Ringu, and I would like to take the Wicker Man to Japan, except this time he's a ghost."
Nice.
Let's do that.
Nice.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
He said that it was, I think it was a Q&A with Empire, he said that, and people started asking Neil Labute about it. And Neil Labute, apparently Nicolas Cage sort of said it with a smile on his face. Is when they wrote that, they were like, there's a wry smile on his face as he's saying that. And Neil Labute was told about it without that explanation. He was like, that's what I love about Nicolas Cage. You know, he's already thought about what we should do with the sequel. And you're like, I don't think he has, Neil. I don't think he has. Paul, what would you change?
What I would change, I think, and obviously this film was not press screen, wasn't preview screen to any critics. They kept all the secrets under wraps. So I think they should have changed the ending. I think Nicholas should have got into the Wicker Man and then he should have kung fu kicked and punched his way out of the Wicker Man. That would have been a fantastic ending. Unlike in the original, where it's inevitable, it's the end, there's nothing you could change about it. This one, he should, you know, punch his way out, do some karate chops, and that's it. That would be the perfect.
What about if
for me, that would be the perfect ending.
And you're absolutely right. What they should have done was just gone all in.
Out, just like cage explode. Yeah. Just, you know, if he bursting out.
If he sort of became some sort of spirit, the Nicolas
like
Cage.
The Wicker God. Nicolas Cage is the Wicker God.
He became the Wicker Man.
Yes.
And he breaks free from his moorings and he tramples round on fire as the Wicker Man, crushing the matriarchy beneath his feet.
I would pay good money to go and see. That would be perfect.
Shouldn't he fly away on two large eagles? as referenced on the last show, if you haven't listened to that.
No, I'm into the Wicker Man coming to life, being powered by Nicolas Cage's cage rage.
That's a deal.
And stomping through the thing, kicking over beehives, going, "Take that, you damn honey!" Great.
Perfect.
I would change. I think I feel like I'm the only one who's brought a serious suggestion to the change this week.
I was being serious.
It's the bit where he swims out to use the plane radio. He jumps into the water. We're on the Pacific coast in the US, so geographically this works. And we've also had the suggestion for this moment set up earlier. I think it would fit in with the Looney Tune logic of this movie and the tone of the film if there was a shark attack. I'd be really up for that. If Nicolas Cage was bothered by a shark as he was swimming out to the plane.
The Wicker Shark.
Hmm? Yep.
A Wicker Shark that joined him in his Wicker battle at the end of the movie. A flying Wicker Shark that he can launch out of his Wicker, flaming Wicker torso.
In the Wickerverse.
Right then. It's going to be brief. 3, 2, 1. Let's do the verdict.
And don't forget, everyone, these two podcasts were about the journey, not the destination.
Yeah. I feel we've been on a journey. I don't disagree with that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, hindsight's 20/20. Should I have paired these movies? Let's leave it out there. Let's leave it out there.
I'm sure we'll be told on Twitter.
So tell me, Chris, what are you picking?
Regarding the Wicker Cage, I do believe that all women are evil and out to get us. And I'm sure if Vicky were here, she would back me up on that.
Tempting fate.
But it is a genuinely bad film. And there really is no reason for it to exist. So I want to quickly just talk about my feelings of The Wicker Man, as I feel a lot about this film. I think it is a bit slow, but that stately place draws you in. But I love the way it defies genre and characterisation. I love how provocative it is. The way it sort of directly attacks Christianity, which is quite a tricky thing to do in the 70s. I feel like it's timeless. Summer Isle is a place out of time that didn't seem contemporary in 73 and doesn't seem particularly out of time now. And paganism is something that's from our past. Stuff like this may very well have happened, and I feel like that's a primal fear it taps into. Like nursery rhymes do, like fairy tales do, and whatever it is, it's sort of generally terrifying. And I also think the best horror films, and I'm going with The Exorcist, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Don't Look Now, The Shining, I think all those films emit a kind of evil that comes off the screen, and I find it deeply upsetting. And The Wicker Man does that better than any film I think I've ever seen, which is why it might be my favourite horror film.
Wow.
Ooh,
that was big.
He was doing that as if he was on the pulpit, wasn't he?
He was. That was a sermon.
Channeling,
he was
preaching.
Channeling Howie.
Big sermon.
So you like the original more than the...
Yes.
Okay. Right.
Oh, so you were talking about the first. Right. Paul, I hope you've written a page of dialogue, a page of prose.
I've done very similar. No, it just... Obviously, The Wicker Man, the original, unimpeachable. They shouldn't have remade it. I mean, as with... Any remakes? If you're gonna remake something, remake something that's got flaws or whatever. Or if you're gonna do something that's unimpeachable, then take it in a different direction, do some different stuff with it. Horror remakes can be done brilliantly. The Fly, you know, Cronenberg's The Fly, and John Carpenter's The Thing, so it can work. But I think in this case, Neil LaBute was the wrong director with the wrong film. The original is unimpeachable, and of course, it's the winner.
Yep, that's a winner then. Two out of three so far. And as much as it is my desire to be contrary, I have to agree. I think for me, it's quite simply like the original Wicker Man is it's clever and all everything you both just said, but it's also it's a very set design, which is a setup and an unexpected punchline, like a joke. And once you've heard that joke, you can't then hear it again, even if you just swap out some of the references for different references. And it's, you know, I mean, if you're calling it... By the way, remember that joke from 1973? I'm going to tell it again. Here we go. You're like, why would you do that? It's a film that exists and can only be seen once. So it is unremakeable and it should never have been remade. And while there is fun to be had in the remake, it's still like... slim pickings, yeah. And you need so much booze. So, the winner is the original Wicker Man.
Hey,
great
that
stuff.
Is a shock.
Yeah, surprise, surprise. Right then, let's look ahead to next week. Chris, your picks for our next Halloween shows, our week two of our big Halloween countdown. You gave us a clue on Tuesday. What is the clue? What are the films?
The clue was Idle Hands Are the Devil's Workshop. Any idea, Paul, what those films might be?
No idea at all.
Is it the 90s movie Idle Hands?
No.
That's what I yes.
It's not the 90s movie Idle Hands.
That's not a bad movie. The Offspring perform a gig in a school in that movie, which I remember watching.
Idle Hands? What
was that? Now you're doing that with your hands. Is it something to do with weapons on the hands, like a hook? Is it Urban Legend?
Elm Street?
It is...
not Urban Legend. I don't know what you did last summer with a fisherman's hook.
No. Alex, I'm giving you...
Nightmare on Elm Street?
Nightmare on Elm Street!
Yes!
I just worked it out because you were doing the knife fingers.
And Vicky, you can't hear me, but I'm giving you Candyman.
Nice.
Okay.
Nice.
That's good.
Yes.
Shall we look even further ahead, though? Because our poll closes in 24 hours for what show we're doing in our... what pairing we're doing in our very final week of our Halloween countdown.
Yeah, we want you to help us. And so we've each picked a pairing and we want you to choose what we're doing. So Alex has got...
The Witches versus Hocus Pocus. Looking for your votes.
Vicky has got Teen Witch and The Craft.
Looking for your votes.
And I've got The Wizard of Oz and Bedknobs and Broomsticks. So do head to @Clash Pod. And also, just before we go, Paul, you won the quiz on the last show. And I've got you a gift. And I forgot to give it to you. You won a prize.
Oh.
So
fantastic.
Are you ready?
This has never happened before.
Wow. Drum roll.
Yep. Wow. Hey, it's a witch's hat. Thank you very much.
Perfect, the witch's hat. Perfect. We'll take a picture so you can all see Paul in his
lovely... I was going to say, perfect for radio.
Paul, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on Clash Pod this week. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, guys.
Paul McAvoy!
Paul McAvoy.
Thank you.
And like Chris said at the start, do check out the website for Frightfest. Is
frightfest.co.uk
for all the latest details about what's taking place this year. As a favour that I ask every time, do get in touch with us at ClashPod or email us show@ClashPod. Rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts, Apple, Spotify or other. It's massively appreciated. We'll be back next week to talk through Nightmare on Elm Street. Candyman.
Stop it.
Bye bye.
This was a Stakhanov production and part of the Acast Creative Network.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection?
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.